Hello and welcome to another edition of Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and today we're going to talk with you about native plants, all kinds of native plants. They are key to sustaining our Midwestern landscape, and they can also offer, of course, natural beauty to your garden or your landscape. With us today, Alan Branhagen. He's Director of Operations at the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum and is the author of this wonderful book I have in front of me. It's called Native Plants of the Midwest. And he's going to talk with us about native plants and, of course, answer your questions as well. Maybe you have native plants growing in your yard. I hope you do. If you don't, maybe you have questions about them. Join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post a question to our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. And I hope you'll share some pictures and photos on our Facebook page as well of your native plants. I always love to see those photos, and it's a great time to do it right here on Garden Talk. And Alan Branhagen, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be on your show.
Man, you've got quite a book here. I tell you what. 500 species of trees, shrubs, vines, perennials, ground covers, bulbs, and annuals.
You bet.
Oh, my goodness. And plants that attract native bees and butterflies and birds and other beneficial wildlife, and you tell us how to cultivate them. Tips for adding natives to your garden.
That's correct. Obviously, the project was a labor of love, and I did it because I think the Midwestern folks just don't necessarily appreciate what we have, and it's kind of funny if you go to a garden center. You may see some of our native plants, but they have cultivar names like Goldsturm and Erbsana and Alma Pachki, and, you know, we don't put them in our gardens until they go to finishing school over in Europe, and that's ridiculous. We have just this incredible resource growing, you know, native in our prairies, wetlands, and forests.
Could we actually do a better job of marketing those plants?
Well, I think it's finally changing. So people are asking the question, is this really truly an indigenous selection or an indigenous plant, and does it still provide nectar for pollinators and seeds for the songbirds and fit into our web of life? So, you know, the public is getting educated. I love that.
Yeah, I do as well. And you're going to find out today that we have some smart people here on Garden Talk on Fridays. And you're going to get some great questions, I think, from them. But, you know, just in general, native plants, they're more sustainable, aren't they, than other types of plants typically for us in the Midwest?
Oh, yeah, obviously they were growing here before there were any gardeners on the, you know, in the soils we have, in the rainfall we have, in the seasons we have, and didn't have anyone, you know, putting any water or fertilizer or, you know, any kind of tend to them, and they did just fine. So you bet. They are meant to be here. As long as you, again, you know, don't put a wetland plant in a dry spot. I mean, common sense things. Put them in the right habitat and conditions that they would have been in the wild, and, yeah, you're good to go.
So a native plant is something that's been here forever? How do you define a native plant?
Well, yeah, something that was an indigenous to a particular area before, you know, Euro-Americans came to the Midwest. Though, you know, native plants, I always like to talk that their ranges were never static. They were always dynamic and changing. And in the big scheme of things, it's not that long ago that the glaciers went out of the Midwest, and it really was mostly what the Northwoods looks like. And you know, ranges of plants, especially with the warming climate, southern things are moving north naturally and assisted by us, and that's the way it's always been. So, I mean, there's a little bit of move around, but again, when you're talking native plants, it's the ones that were here prior to settlement.
Yeah, and they're... So the 500 species of tree, shrubs, vines, perennials, ground covers, bulbs, and annuals... that you have in your book, they are all native plants.
They're all native to the Midwest, right, which I define as really the tall grass prairie and the central hardwood forest, stretching from, you know, Ohio to the Flint Hills of Kansas and from, you know, north central Wisconsin and Minnesota south through the Ozarks into northern Arkansas. So that's kind of the area that I'm, in, you know, included. It's not a political boundary. It's really a natural region.
So, there you go.
Anyway.
Oh, man. Well, so when you think about your own yard, or maybe not, I mean, you're in the sort of the general sense here, let's say my yard or anybody else's yard who's listening. What do you think about when you choose native plants, or what should you think about when you're choosing native plants for a yard or landscape?
Well, obviously you want them to do, want them to function in the landscape. And I always like to start in the Midwest with, well, providing shade in the summertime, thinking of shade trees, and in the wintertime, thinking of evergreen trees to block the winter winds from the northwest. It's amazing how you create a much more sustainable landscape and reduce the heating costs on your home just by that proper placement. Thinking of ground covers and how important they are for, you know, instead of turf grass, I mean native ground covers instead of turf grasses or hard surfaces, and how that reduces summertime temperatures and, you know, makes, you know, water get into the groundwater better, rainfall into the groundwater better, and also provides, you know, food for the web of life around us. So I like the story that if you think you can live without wild things, you should know that you cannot, because we need them there for pollinators and all the other ecosystem services that they provide.
Well, we have every one of our lines filled, so lots of good questions coming, I'll bet. Let's go to Angie in Appleton with who has a question. Hi, Angie. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Alan.
Morning.
I just have a really, really quick question for you. We have some land up in the Northwoods. What type of native grasses can I use for ground cover? Because obviously fescue and bluegrass, those things aren't going to work.
You have sandy soils there, obviously, then.
Yeah, I'd like to say it's a little bit of sand, but who am I trying to kid? It's mostly sand.
Mostly sand. Well, there's a great native ground cover called Pennsylvania sedge that should really, I mean, it almost is like a spectacular turf, and it spreads in a nice uniform manner. And the one thing is, you don't have to mow it. It only gets, you know, about, I don't know, 4 inches high or so. So that would be my first choice. It's often native in a lot of sand, savanna, natural areas, and it just is like an amazing natural turf.
Give us the name again.
Pennsylvania sedge, Carex pennsylvanica. And I know that one, you know, like Prairie Nursery up there in Westfield, Wisconsin, carries that. And, you know, there's some other sedges might work, but that's one of the best.
Okay, so it's sedge, S-E-D-G-E?
Yes, S-E-D-G-E, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. You have a great weekend.
Yeah, you as well. Thank you for calling. Well, let's go to Patty in Monches. Have I got that name right, Patty?
Yeah, that's it. It's Monches.
And where's that located?
It's probably between Heartland and Hartford.
All right, gotcha.
Okay.
And you have a comment for us.
Well, I have a question about my prairie, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I would like to ask Alan, I have maybe two-thirds of an acre of prairie, and I have a lot of really good native in there. I planted it years ago, and it's sort of been overtaken by a lot of the really tall things, and I haven't been able to see very many of the shorter things. It just doesn't look very pretty like the last couple of years. And I asked a prairie nursery guy last fall, and he told me to bale it for the horses, and I really can't do that. There might be things in there that might not be good for them.
Really?
So my plan is, I have a lot of lupin that come up and are beautiful for a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And what I'm thinking of doing is, after they're finished blooming, just doing a cutting so that the tall things might not get so tall. Mm-hmm. Is that something that I might have some success with, or do you have a different idea for me?
Well, I think they're right on that cutting the prairie, either baling it to, actually prairie hay usually sells for pretty well, but I mean, even if you you have to be careful on when you do it because you don't want it to smother things below. But that is going to reduce the vigor of those big grasses. And if you read my book, of course, I really in starting a prairie, some of the big bluestem Indian grass, switchgrass are really aggressive plants. And when people start a prairie, they really should use very small components of those and make sure that the smaller grasses and even sedges, which constantly get forgotten in prairie restorations, even though they're important components of prairie. You really need to get the smaller things really set in first, and then you have better structure. And also a lot of the spring plants in prairie restorations almost never get installed. But since you're already past that point, the best thing you can do is reduce the vigor of those grasses, and yeah, probably cutting them is the best.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
So like maybe a late June cutting, I might have some success with that.
I would do it later than that.
I
would probably do it in the latter part of July. Let's see, over by Milwaukee, I'm trying to, I'm so used to, I'd lived in Missouri for the past 20 years, and though I did grow up next to Wisconsin in Decorah, Iowa, close to Wisconsin. But usually it's kind of, latter part of summer is better, so I would say later than that. And then you're not impacting, songbird nesting and that kind of thing as well.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. You can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Call in with your questions. Robert in New Berlin, we'll go to you next. Hi, Robert.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Make a long story short, my wife went to her garden club yesterday, and she came home, and she was in full panic about jumping worms that they talked about for an hour and a half with their guest speaker. And the question I've got for you is, how concerned are you about the jumping worms that she is informing me about? And is the University of Minnesota doing any research on how to biologically attack them or anything?
I don't know what jumping worms are. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Do you have any other detail on what they are?
They're terrible. They're terrible little worms that essentially they jump. There's a good name for them. But
uh-huh.
they destroy the vegetation wherever they are. And we have an influx of them in Wisconsin. I know they're mm-hmm. in the Madison area. It sounds like they're now in the New Berlin area as well.
Mm.
We don't have a way to get rid of them.
Are they true, like the earthworms or what? Or
no,
are
no,
they
no,
caterpillars?
No,
or are they sawflies? Or?
No, they're an invasive.
Yeah, but what group of worms?
They're worms.
Worms. Okay, like annelids, like
yeah.
Earthworms. Okay. Huh, no, I'm news to me. Sorry, I'm here in Minnesota now. I don't know if I'm in Iowa and or Missouri, so.
Well, you're going to hear about them.
You got me on that one.
You're gonna,
yeah, thanks for the heads up.
You
don't send them this way.
You should Google jumping worms. Next chance you get, because they're going to be in Minnesota and they're going to be mm-hmm. in Iowa too. I'm pretty sure
mm-hmm.
of that.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately,
okay.
And maybe we've got a DNR type or another gardening expert who can give us
sure.
a little more on jumping worms. Call
sure.
in if you do. Rose in Cumberland, we'll go to you next. Hi, Rose.
Hi. So my question is that Honeynut Cheerios has been sending out these seed packets to help with bees, but then I was reading some articles that some of the seeds can be actually more toxic to the other native plants and to the bees. Have you heard about anything like this? Did you think they're okay to plant, or what do you think I should do?
I've heard two sides to that story, and I actually haven't seen the packet and what seeds are in it. Do you have the packet right there to tell me what species are in it?
I do, but it doesn't say what species. It just says to water till the dirt, and that's it. It doesn't say what kind of plants are in it or anything like that.
Sure. I'm usually, those kind of mixes I'm usually a little leery of, because a lot of times they don't really have species that are indigenous to our area, though. If if they have things that are truly beneficial to pollinators, it's probably still overall a good thing. But I really can't comment without knowing specifically what the plants in the packet are.
Okay. Yeah, all it says is wildflower mix.
Usually I stay away from those, you know, because they do have a lot of not truly native species in them. So that's just my general rule of thumb that I can give as advice to you.
All right.
Awesome. That works. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Visiting today with Alan Branhagen, who is the author of a great new book. It's called Native Plants of the Midwest, A Comprehensive Guide to the Best 500 Species for the Garden. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post a photo and or question on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Lexi Brode, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Next week on Garden Talk, we'll talk about fruit crops with three guests. So I hope you can join us for that. Right now, we're taking a look at native plants of the Midwest. And frankly, that's the title of the book written by Alan Branhagen. Great to have him along. He is now director of operations at Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. And it's wonderful to have him with us today. And certainly join in with your questions and comments. Again, our lines are about filled up right now, but the number is 800-642-1234. Let's go to Mary in Pewaukee next. Mary, hello.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Hello. I have a question. We had to have some trees cut down, pine trees that got that fungus, you know, because they are not native to here. They're from Colorado. And we wanted to find out what else we can plant as kind of a hedge or have some privacy. And so there's a lot of pine needles in that area. And so that's one question. And what would you believe might be a really good, fast-growing, something that we can purchase that might already be 2 or 3 feet tall, mm-hmm. and that would work well in Zone 5? And then one other question is, quickly, is does English lavender work well with pine needles on the ground?
Well, your first part of your question, do you want something that is evergreen, or are you okay with it being deciduous as you're hedging, and how tall do you want it to get?
Sure, preferably evergreen, and one of the, they also had to cut down, this is on the east side that that I'm talking about, but we planted some junipers on the north side. They're not doing all that well, but we do prefer something that would be evergreen.
What height, probably?
Yes. We'd probably prefer something that doesn't get more than 15 or 20 feet.
Okay.
Right.
Would be adequate.
Sure. Well, the Midwest is not blessed with that many native evergreens, and of course, the native eastern red cedar is probably the most widespread of the Midwestern evergreens, and of course, it normally gets larger than that over time, becomes actually a good-sized tree. But there are some selections of it that are usually shorter that you could use, but do you have full sun conditions? I keep asking you these kinds of questions because there's so many variables.
Yeah. Well, the east side gets mostly, I would say, 3/4 of the day it probably has sun.
Right. Yeah, that should be enough for any kind of juniper. And again, it's Juniperus virginiana is the native species. The jack pine also would work. It'll get taller over time. And if you go to you don't have my shrub book in front of you. There are, again, smaller selections of some of these that might work. For what you're saying, though, it sounds like something that's deciduous might be better for the size that you want it to be, and something like a thicket of gray dogwood or of hazelnut or arrowwood viburnum or nannyberry viburnum, something like that actually might be better for you. And they do, you know, thicken up so that they become a pretty good screen over time.
Yeah, those are good ideas, actually.
Great, sure. And what about that English lavender? Will that grow within pine needle?
It usually needs good drainage, and that's the most important thing. I don't know that acid soil is detrimental. I think that it actually prefers a more neutral soil. But just good drainage is the most important thing on lavender.
All right. All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Mary. Appreciate it. And Anne in Random Lake, let's go to you next. Hi, Anne.
Hi, I had a question about prairie grass because we have about, well, probably 14 or 15 or so acres of prairie grass. The state actually put it in. We have the Indian, the switch, and the big blue stem. And we've had it burned a couple times. We cut it sometimes. We cut it, the weeds, you know, early in the season sometimes. To get the seed heads off. But my question was just generally what you would recommend between they did burn it a couple times. So between spraying, cutting, and burning, what you might recommend and when to maintain it in the long run, or, you know, how often?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, are you wanting to enhance it with more wildflowers or?
Not necessarily, no.
Not necessarily. Okay, well then, usually just a dormant season burn is the best. And if you're having problems with cool season grasses getting in, burning later, like actually here at the Arboretum, they're burning today some of the plantings that have a lot of brome coming in, a non-native cool season grass, and by burning them now, that's already greened up, and you really hit that hard while our native grasses like Indian switch and big blue stem haven't come out of dormancy yet. So mid-spring burn really, really can help, and any kind of spring burn actually really invigorates the growth of those big warm season grasses like Indian switch and big blue stem.
Yeah.
So, okay, great. Thank you.
It's always fun for me to see a burn area. Just, you look at that burn area and it looks awful. But then you come back a week later and things are starting to look pretty good. And then in a couple of weeks, man, things are going.
Things are really going. Yeah, that was when I worked at Powell Gardens before this, which is Kansas City's botanical garden. And we had a beautiful Fay Jones chapel set in a prairie. And I had to really be careful when we'd burn that because we would rent that out to brides. And they would be very unhappy with a black landscape. So we would burn it in spring so it would quickly green up. And it always is shocking how fast it greens up.
You know, you're now Director of Operations at Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, and I don't know a lot about that. I haven't been there. Tell us about that arboretum.
Well, it's been around since the late 50s as an arboretum here. It's about 25 miles southwest of Minneapolis in the suburb of Chanhassen, 1,200 acres of ground.
Wow.
Right now we're about a mile west of Paisley Park, so with the anniversary of Prince's death today, we've got a lot of people around here. It's a really a great garden I've loved since I was a teenager growing up in the northeast corner of Iowa, has just really nice natural areas and collections of plants. It has, you know, beautiful wetlands, beautiful examples of the big woods with lots of great sugar maples that they tap for sugar here, or, you know, maple syrup, and has the oldest prairie restoration in Minnesota, which is pretty neat. The Dayton Wildflower Garden, really great example of woodland wildflowers, and a prairie garden as well. So it's just a great all-around garden, one of the largest in the Midwest, and I'm excited to be here. Kind of was a childhood dream to work here one day, and it happened.
Yeah, that is great. And you folks, your website, I think we have your website up on our Facebook page. Lexi, do we have it up there? Yeah, she'll get it up if we don't have it up there.
But one thing I got to plug, too, is it's one of the few gardens, I mean, has such beautiful, big, old oak trees with branches to the ground. And, that things like that are things that money can't buy or plant. They're things that are inherited and you have to be good stewards of. And it's just a great, great place to see gardening in all styles. We do have, you know, colorful displays, great tulip display coming here this summer. But we have, you know, again, the full range of collections out here.
And I had a, there was a question here, and I'm trying to find it now. Oh, okay. Mary Ellen on Facebook asks if there are any good native trees to replace her ash trees, which were lost to the emerald ash borer.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's I'm so cautious without knowing exact conditions. But, you know, first and foremost, I think of the Kentucky coffee tree as being a great shade tree that's a good replacement. The native honey locust, thornless varieties, obviously, in a you know, a human setting is pretty important. And the swamp white oak is really one of the most popular recommended shade trees right now, though I really like to promote our oaks because really they have the most important impact on the nature of a site, having the most species of wildlife tied to them, from everything from many, many species of moths to, of course, songbirds are the number one mast crop. So I always try to get people to think about whatever species of oak is suitable for the conditions you have. So the hackberry is another tree I really like, great for songbirds and wildlife, and kind of looks like the old American elm. So those are some ideas I recommend on replacing ash trees with emerald ash borer. And, of course, if you do have an ash tree that's in really good shape and really an important part of a garden, you know, it really is worth it to treat it and protect it from the borer.
Yeah, absolutely. Lisa in Racine has a question for you. Hi, Lisa.
Oh, hi. I'm excited to check out this new book. This sounds very good. And my question is, I am trying to kind of landscape the side of my house, and I want to use native plants. So I have a few like, the coneflower and Joe Pye weed and bleeding heart and some of those things. And I don't necessarily want them to get to spread too much. I want to kind of make it look a little more formal because it is mm-hmm. a residential area. And is it okay to mulch around them to keep them from getting, spreading? And if so, what kind of mulch would you recommend?
First of all, in my book, each chapter, I did put together a little list of what I thought were the most suitable for a traditional landscape. So if you're talking a full sun... As long as you're talking full sun, you said like things like coneflower, you know, the butterfly milkweed and the blue wild indigo, the showy coreopsis, yeah, purple coneflower, the prairie blazing star, little blue stem, prairie drop seed. Those are plants that really don't seed themselves all over and usually stay in you know, where they're planted, is a concern under those kind of settings. So I tried to cover that in each chapter. I do have to, on mulch, the only reason I mulch is to protect new plantings and hold in moisture. I'll just say what British gardeners laugh at Americans, that we like to show our mulch instead of our plants. But I understand that, you know, that helps it tie into the neighborhood. But, you know, we really need to be making sure plants actually fill in. It really is a more sustainable garden that way.
Okay, that sounds good then.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Kate in Fox Cities. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the feasibility or the propriety of transplanting a native fern from a wooded area to my shaded backyard. Mm-hmm. This is a very tall fern. It's beautiful, probably when it's fully grown, maybe 4 feet tall, 3 or 4 feet mm-hmm. tall. And
sure.
It's in shade. And I've often wondered, gosh, could I just grab one of those and see if it would work in my backyard?
Well, you know, we really want you to have permission to do that and to make sure, you know, obviously don't do that on public land or any place where you don't have permission. We really try to promote people to purchase nursery grown stock so that we aren't impacting, you know, natural areas. But especially if there's If there's a good population of them, it's a friend of yours, and they don't mind you dividing out a piece and gave you permission. Usually there's really not that much harm done with that, but for the most part, frown upon that. Moving ferns, it's best in late winter, early spring, as soon as the ground is workable. And before the little fiddleheads even emerge from the crown of the plant, if you wait till after that, the plant is just really demanding of moisture and wilty, and usually takes quite a hit. So, but first of all, I would recommend go to Prairie Nursery or Prairie Moon Nursery in Winona and Westfield, Wisconsin, and look at what they have for ferns and start there.
That's awfully good information. Thank you. Let me just ask, how would I find out what kind of fern this is? Could I take a picture of it and then go to one of those nurseries?
Sure. I bet they would identify it for you. Yeah, take a picture of it. That always works. Picture says 1,000 words. And it's obviously one of the larger ferns. It's probably something like cinnamon fern. But, again, without a picture, I can't tell you for sure.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Pamela posted a great picture on Facebook of bumblebees nectaring on her lavender hyssop, and she says that since she's started planting native plants in her flower beds, the butterflies, bees, and hummingbird visits have increased every single year.
That's exactly what happens. If you plant it, they will come. And, yeah, Anis hyssop is probably one of the very best of our natives for attracting an incredible variety of pollinators, bees and butterflies, and then even the seeds on it. Well, the seed heads in the winter are beautiful in the winter landscape, and things like goldfinches will eat the seeds out of it. So it's a tremendous native.
And Candy, who lives in central Wisconsin, emailed to ask what native plants would grow well in wet clay soil.
Always a challenge, isn't it? Yeah. Well, again, wet clay. What would I do in wet clay? I would go to the wetland chapter of my book. There are, things like the swamp milkweed is a great choice. You're going to help the monarch butterfly with that. It's a great, great pollinator plant. Palm sedge, Carex muscingamensis, is a really beautiful plant that likes that kind of condition. The native turtle heads, colony, there's a white one would be native to Wisconsin. It's a beautiful, beautiful plant. Joe pieweed loves wet clay soils. That's the eutrochium, formerly eupatorium, things like has an awful, again, marketing problem, sneezeweed, or Helen's flower. It's actually a beautiful yellow daisy with a little knob center, and it's called sneezeweed. I guess allegedly the Native Americans made a snuff out of it to rid yourself of evil spirits, but it really is a great late-season garden flower. The native blue flag iris is going to love those conditions, the scarlet cardinal flower. Lobelia cardinalis. So there really are a bunch of some of the smooth phlox and marsh phlox are going to like those conditions. So you've actually got a good suite of plants that would work well for that.
And let's see, we've got another comment from Ellen on Facebook. Would like recommendations for shade-loving native plants and shrubs for her yard, which is now full of oaks and maples.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. I would love to have the new house I'm buying does have oaks and maples. I'm excited about that. Well, you want to start with the spring wildflowers, and then that like the shady conditions, and there's many to choose from. Dutchman's breeches is one of my absolute favorites for that. But then don't forget summertime and especially fall. There are some really nice fall fruiting. Well, there's fall asters, the zigzag goldenrod, the elm leaf goldenrod, some of the like the blue wood aster for fall color, and then the berries on things like baneberries. They have a neat little white sparkler flower in the spring, but then either depending on which species you have, red or white berries in the fall. Things like Jack in the Pulpit is a great native bulb with a beautiful spring flower and a beautiful red fruit in the fall. Solomon's Seal, another great plant with neat bell-shaped flowers in the spring that the hummingbirds come to, and then in the fall, great yellow fall color with the beautiful blue berries dangling beneath the stem. False Solomon seals, another one, has kind of a plume-like white head and late head of flowers in the spring, late spring, actually going into summer, and then beautiful red berries in the fall. But I think people, when they think shade, unfortunately, they gravitate so much to spring, and that is when spring gardens in the shade are best, but don't forget to add those summer attributes. For shrubs, one of my favorite shady shrubs that's finally getting some recognition is the leatherwood, Dirca palustris.
Oh. Neat
little shrub with yellow dangling flowers in the early spring, and actually by late spring has beautiful red berries and then great fall color. And it's beautiful grayish kind of rubbery stems. I guess the Native Americans actually, you know, used the bark as a leather substitute. I mean, it's really pliable, but it's a really completely underutilized shrub, in my opinion.
And tell us the name of that again.
Leatherwood, Dirca, D-I-R-C-A, palustris. And it's one of...
I don't know that, but that sounds great.
Yeah, it's native. I bet it's native throughout Wisconsin. It's native into Minnesota, eastern Iowa, down into Missouri. And it depends on what, you know, there actually is a native hydrangea. It's not native to Wisconsin, but south of Wisconsin. And with changing climates, it's a great shade lover. You must get the lace cap variety, the wild variety of it. Has incredible pollen for all kinds of pollen-gathering insects. It's one of the best. And even, you know, some things like the native Missouri gooseberry, it's not just to Missouri, it's found throughout most of Wisconsin, and early to leaf out, those pretty little shooting star-like flowers for the bumblebees, and then you can eat the gooseberries yourself that are produced on it. Though it is kind of a prickly shrub, but, you know, just depending on how you use it in your garden.
Is that an erect or a trailing...
It actually is an upright, yeah.
And
wherever a tip hits the ground, it sprouts a new one, but not obnoxiously so. I mean, I had it native in my Missouri garden, and obviously native in where I grew up in Iowa, and I grew to like it over time. You know, it's just kind of one of those sleepers. It really, it's so neat that it leafs out so early, and then, you know, you get to enjoy the fruit off of it. And, of course, the edible component of all this is really becoming a hot topic, and I see that, you know, next week you're going to have that on your agenda, which is great. If you have acid soils, she's mentioned oaks. If she has sandy or acid soils, of course, the native blueberries are really tremendous ornamentals. To use, as long as it's light shade or high shade, they'll be fine. So
you have the right soil.
Yeah, obviously you need the right soil. You have to amend the soil, and sometimes that kind of defeats the purpose of what we're talking about being sustainable. If you can't work with the soils you have, then, you know. So
yeah.
Anyway,
there we go, Alan Branhagen, our guest today. He is the author of Native Plants of the Midwest, a comprehensive guide to the best 500 species for the garden. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the book Native Plants of the Midwest with its author, Alan Branhagen, who is Director of Operations at Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. Great to have him along. I have a lot of fun talking with him today about native plants of all types, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post a photo and or question on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And let's see, Alan, we're going to go to Whitefish Bay next and talk with Joan. Joan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, you're welcome. Very interesting program. I have a prairie garden in the middle of a rather formal landscape area here. It's about, we have almost an acre, I think, of land. And this
prairie garden has gone astray, and it's very wild and scraggly. And I just wonder whether we should have the area just plowed up and start over with, you know, just laying a ground cover or what we should do. And then in the front of it, along the driveway, we should have a low-growing shrub to sort of delineate or make a border of this area. So that's my problem.
Okay.
Well, sometimes, I mean, I hate to say it, I really do promote prairie gardens, but sometimes if they have got, if they were planted with too many of, the, again, the big robust species, starting over to me is just a fine option. But make sure with your new planting you get in some of the, like I said in an earlier call, some of the more smaller of the grasses that really fill in and hold it and make it a little more controlled looking, like prairie dropseed and little bluestem and side oats grandma are three, you know, Wisconsin native ones that really help. And also getting in some of the more of the tougher wildflowers like the cream wild indigo and the purple and white prairie clovers and things like that. And then don't plant so many of the great big grasses and only put them in after those other things have been more established. And that will help you in that respect.
That sounds like good advice. Then I would have to have a prairie landscaper come in, wouldn't I, to do a credible job?
Likely you'd have to have a have someone come in to do that for you. Yeah. I would think.
Alan Brandhagen, director of operations.
Yeah. Okay.
And
it's got a sunny area for three quarters of the day, and it's kind of dry clay-y soil. And as I say, it's just gone wild now, and it's too tall. We can't see the rest of the property and all that.
I think, you know, hang on there, Joan. I think we lost our guest somehow. Just
dear.
And Lexi, Lexi, maybe you can call our guest back because we lost our guest.
I thank you so much, though, for taking my call. I enjoy the program immensely. Thank you.
And you wanted a low-growing native shrub, right?
Yes, that we could prune and keep in shape. About maybe it would grow about a foot high. I was wondering about a miniature, what they call flaming bush, euonymus, I think it is. A miniature euonymus as a hedge, and then keep it, it's a small area, so we could keep it pruned back.
And by small area, how long or how?
The hedge would be about maybe 12 feet, 14 feet.
Okay. And I think we have Alan back. Alan, are you there? No, Lexi, we still don't have Alan back.
Yeah. Okay.
So I've got your note here, and we will... We'll get Alan back on, and we will keep going with the show.
Address it to him, and he's very knowledgeable. He really is wonderful.
Oh, he does a wonderful job, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness! Thank you so much, and Joan, and we'll see. We'll see if we can get. I'm sure we'll be able to get him back on. And while we're waiting for him to get back on, I just want to go back through the book itself, The Native Plants of the Midwest, A Comprehensive Guide to the Best 500 Species for the Garden. He has, I don't know, I'm going to ask him how many photos he has, but he has photos, I think, of every one of the plants that he has discussed in the book. So he's got somewhere around so he's got about 500 or so. He's got at least 500 photos of the plants, and so actually I think he's probably got closer to 1,000 photos. I'll ask him that. But as we look at the table of contents, we can talk about that with him as well. I think we've got him back on. Alan, are you there?
I'm back. I have no idea what happened. I didn't touch anything. I'll admit. So anyway.
I tell you, Joan was, let's go right back to her, because she was looking for a low-growing native shrub.
Right.
And she wondered about euonymus, a native euonymus.
Right.
But
it gets really big, and as you know, the native wahoo can get quite tall, you know, at least 8 feet tall, and it can actually be a little scruffy. I actually prefer it more of a natural landscape on the edge of a woods or in a woodland setting where I think it works better. So there's things that I was talking along and not realizing you weren't there anymore. So things like the black chokeberry and the calm St. John's wort, the Hypericum shrub, those are some really good Wisconsin natives that stay pretty tidy and tight. That Potentilla, actually the native form of it, if you can get it, is a really, really good choice as well. And those are the ones I was talking out until I realized that you weren't there anymore.
That was strange. We haven't had that happen before. So, well, I'm glad we got you back. And Joan, thank you again. Let's go to Mary in Watertown next. Mary, hi to you.
Hi, thanks for the show. I have a question on my lawn. Over the last decade, a small patch of very thick grass has been spreading. It has really grown quite large in area. The first to turn brown in the fall and the last to turn green. But then it's like carpet grass, and I was told it was a native to this area called buffalo grass, and so I was wondering what the guest knows about that.
I do know about buffalo grass, but I'd be really surprised that that would come up in Wisconsin like that, because it's really more of a Great Plains species. And actually, even in Kansas City, we'd have trouble working with it because it almost sounds like something else. And I don't know, Larry, it sounds like Zoysia, but I don't know if Zoysia would ever get that far north. Larry, I don't know.
Unfortunately, it's marketed here in Wisconsin.
It is.
You see it in it's not something you should plant, and it's possible that it's spread or somehow you got it from the neighbors or something, but it's a terrible grass for our state in my opinion.
Well, right, I hated it in Missouri too, and it would come in. And I think she's talking about Zoysia, because the native, if it was a native sedge or one of the other grasses, it just wouldn't act like that. I would say that's what it is.
And so to get rid of something like that, Alan, what do you do? Are there non-chemical ways? Can you dig those up?
Well, what you would probably do is when it's green, you would, if you wanted it non-chemical, then you'd put down like black plastic or something to literally fry it out and then seed back in the lawn mix that you want. And of course, there are some really nice low-maintenance lawn mixes like, you know, Prairie Nursery Cells, and look into those, because I think they're a neat alternative.
Yeah, I would agree. And Prairie Nursery is certainly one. There are other native nursery plants around the state that can offer that kind of help, Mary. And I'd think about getting rid of it. You know, of course, it can be. You can probably get rid of it chemically as well. You might think about starting up with some natives, as Alan has suggested. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Troy in Appleton. Troy, hello.
Hello. I was interested, Larry, in wondering whether there was an agency such as Department of Agriculture or such that would help assist me in acquiring some wildflower seeds or such. I just recently became a beekeeper. I just acquired some hives, and I would like to put them in their right territory.
Yeah. Well, do you have room to grow natives?
Two to three acres.
You got 2 to 3 acres. Well, you've got a lot of space. He's got a lot of space there, Alan.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, in terms of cost sharing, I don't know for your state, obviously, but there are some really nice, you can get some seed mixes from more of a local-based native plant nursery that would have ones more specific to your area rather than kind of the meadow in a can thing you want to stay away from. And, again, I know Prairie and Prairie Moon both sell those kind of mixes, and I'm sure some other nurseries would as well that can get you started with great native, locally native plants that are good for pollinators.
And you can do, if you're buying seeds, certainly if you buy plants, that can be expensive. But the seeds, right. Well, seeds are expensive too in a way, but not nearly as expensive as buying the plants. So you can, if you're willing to do a lot of the work yourself, the nice thing about these nurseries is that they offer a lot of guidance in terms of getting something like that started and keeping it going properly. And in your book as well, you talk about some of that in terms of plants that certainly will attract bees and the natives.
You bet. I try to include that for every species because I just think that's one of the most important reasons we bring in natives. And, some of them attract more species than others, but, all of them have something that works for something out there. And things like the wild geranium and the spring beauty, common native spring wildflowers to Wisconsin, have specific bees that are tied just to them. So that's why you want diversity as well as some of these ones that attract a lot of pollinators.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, our guest today is Alan Branhagen. Alan directs operations at Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, and he is the author of the book we are talking about, Native Plants of the Midwest, A Comprehensive Guide to the Best 500 Species for the Garden. Taking a look at native plants today for your garden and for your landscape, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Alan Branhagen, Director of Operations at the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, and author of the book Native Plants of the Midwest. And we can talk about trees and shrubs, perennials, and a whole lot more. And you may have some questions. I hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And Alan, we have Wayne in Green Bay with a question for us. So let's go there. Wayne, hello. Thank you for calling.
Well, hello, and thanks for having me on. Hi, Alan. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Hello.
You were talking about the Pennsylvania sedge earlier as a ground cover instead of a lawn. And I was considering it for quite a while for my front yard, doing something like that. But I was concerned about being in the shade. And I was wondering if it would work in the shade. And it is. I have several oaks and maples in my yard, plus along the edges I have some white pines and jack pines and that. But I don't have. But I was concerned about if I'd go through the whole effort and then not have it grow.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Pennsylvania sedge is it can grow in full sun and to moderate shade. You may want to switch to a different species where closer to the pines and the maples where you have a denser shade. There's one Carex rosea, the eastern star sedge, that is very similar to Pennsylvania sedge, but it's more tolerant of shade and does the same type of thing. It kind of becomes a light turf. It would be my next choice for that.
Mm-hmm.
What was that again?
Carex rosea. So again, Carex is a genus for sedge, C-A-R-E-X, and then rosea, R-O-S-E-A, and it is more shade tolerant.
And its common name is. Common name?
I think it's eastern star sedge. There's two species that are very similar, Carex radiata and Carex rosea, but it's Carex rosea you would want. It's more spreading into a turf type in my experience. And you see it often as a really nice carpet in sugar maple woods. So it would be a good choice where there's more shade.
All right. There we go. Thanks so much for calling, Wayne. Let's go to Ken in Mundelein, Illinois. Hi, Ken.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Great. Appreciate the call.
I had a brief comment about your caller maybe 10 minutes ago about buffalo grass, and I wanted to say that I got an infestation of buffalo grass in my lawn here in northern Illinois, and I did have it positively ID'd, and so I can tell you that it definitely does somehow end up in some people's lawns up here, and yes, that stuff is pure evil. And the way you can tell, especially, I mean, it's completely different from, you know, Kentucky bluegrass or turf-type tall fescue. You can tell because in the fall it will send up, it has male and female plants, and so you'll get these little seed burrs that kind of grow down in the turf, closer to the ground, and then it'll send up these little, they look like a little flag almost, that's the male flower, and so that's how you can tell. And they have stolons, you know, which are those runners that run along the ground and put down new roots at each node. So it's tough to get rid of. It seemed like it really liked to thrive in that strip of yard between the sidewalk and the street where it gets real hot and nasty and dry and stuff, and where, you know, my Kentucky bluegrass has trouble really thriving. So it seems like it does better in adverse and dry conditions.
Yeah, that's right. It's a Great Plains native, so... I am very familiar with it, but it's a constant struggle to keep it because it can't compete so well with the cool season grasses. Normally, in most of the Midwest, it really prefers being further west. But
yeah, doesn't.
You know,
sound...
I'm sure there's situations like everything that it just is different. But
it didn't sound like the description that earlier caller gave us. It really sounded more like zoysia grass to me. But it's possible. Anything's possible,
at first,
Ken.
At first, people thought that it was, I submitted some pictures online, and they say, oh, yeah, it's Bermuda. You know, it's definitely Bermuda that you got in. But no, it was most definitely Buffalo. So.
All right. Thanks for calling. Oh, boy. Alan Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Al.
Hey, good morning, Larry.
Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. My question has to do also with ground cover. I have a very shady, maybe 300 square foot in my backyard. My neighbor's maple overhangs it, and it's always shade. I don't want to grow grass back there because I don't really use that area. I have a couple of hostas that will grow back there, but we're talking about this star. Is this a low? Is that a low growing?
Yeah, it's
very low.
Very low. Yes, it's very low growing. It might be, 4 to 6 inches at most, but it's light and wispy, so it doesn't, you know, it's very nice plant.
Okay.
And other things, like wild ginger. I mean, I don't know what if you want to, obviously there's a lot of choices for shady ground covers, and it is, without seeing the site, it can be a little challenging to know what will work. But yeah, the Carex rosea would be a good choice.
Yeah.
All right. And where would I buy those plants? Any nursery would have them, or?
Native theme nursery should have them. I mean, I know for sure that, Prairie Nursery and Prairie Moon did have them. So those are major mail orders in the upper Midwest that deal with native plants, and I'm sure there's other ones that would as well.
Yeah, there we go. All right. Al, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And on to Dan in Marshfield. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jim. Great show. I have a lovely little round lobes hepatica that comes up every spring in kind of a real woody area of my backyard. And I was just wondering if there's anything I can do to encourage this little spring ephemeral flower to spread, or if I'm just going to have to enjoy the one little plant that comes up faithfully every year. Thanks.
That's a really good comment. I don't know if hepatica needs a pollinator. If it's all by itself, some of these natives, it's amazing. Like a lot of the asters have to have a cross pollinator set seed. They're not self-fertile, just like a lot of our fruit trees. So, and I honestly don't know on hepatica. Normally, if you have a little drift of them native, you usually get some seedlings and you get more plants of it. But it might be that it's self-sterile, so that's why you're not getting any seedlings. You might want to go ahead and purchase a couple more plants from a native nursery and plant them by there and see if that will do the trick to get you to get some seedlings going.
Okay, I'll do that then, because it's such a, mm-hmm. a beautiful, beautiful little flower, and it comes up every year right around Mother's Day, and we always look forward to it.
One of my favorite three spring wildflowers, so I'm with you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah.
Great show.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Thank you very much for calling. Cindy in Oregon, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Yes, I wanted to share just some tips that I had learned from years. I worked for the Blue Mounds Area Project, which is a nonprofit based out of Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, that works with landowners in conservation issues, a wonderful group to look into and get involved with. But we would work with some landowners who had large parcels of land, particularly interested in pollinators, to plant what we would call seed gardens. And so you could use a mixture of plants and seeds in a small area, intensively plant those with the plants that you're looking for, and then as those mature into a seed, seed-producing, you know, as they hit 2 or 3 years, you could then use those to seed into the rest of your property. And in that way, you're sharing a cost, you're slowing down your needs right away to do a large-scale expansion. It allows you more control because you're basically doing it in small stages, but you're also then being able to keep your cost down with that initial planting. And so it's a really good way to be able to afford some of the cost of some of the higher-priced seed that perhaps are the plants. But then use that to seed in the rest of your area. We found that works very well for people.
That sounds like a great idea, doesn't it, Alan?
Yes, couldn't agree with you more, and I am familiar with that way. So glad you called in with that.
Yeah, thanks, Cindy.
Yeah. You're welcome. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that as a beekeeper myself, honeybees love as well a lot of the culinary herbs that we plant in our own gardens. They're wonderful sources. Not only for us, but for them, you'll find that even like thyme, there's some people who do holistic beekeeping who like to plant. For example, thyme is something that we use that's good for them to be feeding on. It's good for their system. It's good for their holistic health, but it's also something that we benefit from as well. And they love those herbs. It's a European, as a European species, the honeybee is very attracted to things like that. So instead of doing it in flower form, if you do it in things that are in your own garden, it's another way to increase your pollinator attraction.
Alan, comment?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and I'm aware of that. Yes, herbs are tremendous for that. So
yeah, very good advice. Thanks, Cindy. Appreciate your call. I want to give Mike and Oshkosh a chance to join in. Mike, hello to you.
Hello. Wondering about something that I've heard called snow on the mountain. Someone suggested it might work for me. I don't know if it's native or not, but I've got an area under some rather tall blue spruce that have been trimmed up to about 5 feet, mm-hmm. and there isn't really anything that wants to grow under there grass-wise.
It is a very challenging condition. It's such dense shade, and then the roots of that spruce, and then how... And, you know, just the density of that plant doesn't allow much to grow under there. And even in nature, there wouldn't be much under there. But snow in the mountain is actually a non-native, and it's an aggressive. I wouldn't recommend it. It's really called goutweed. And then the variegated form with the white-edged leaves that ends up in people's gardens as a pass-along plant is what they're talking about. But I wouldn't do it because it is an aggressive non-native, and I really don't recommend it. I'm trying to think of some of the best dry shades for under a spruce, though, that are native, and the best I can come up with, again, are those sedges. Might be some of your best choices. Under a red cedar in my Missouri house, I used the little lesser pussy toes. If you have enough light, that might work. It's a native one that has kind of a grayish green leaf and little white flowers in the spring that look like little pussy toes, and that's how it gets its name, and it kind of spreads into a flat carpet. Good for pollinators, and it's also a host plant for the American lady butterfly. So it it's one that I probably would try under there. I'm skimming through there, and those are the two that come to mind. Pussy Toes. Antenaria is the genus, A-N-T-E-N-N-A-R-I-A.
Okay.
Antenaria neglecta. So you may want to try that at least where on the edge where it's a little more light and see if it'll sneak under there some more.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Jacob on Facebook wonders if you have any plant ideas for a small, steep, north-facing hill that is covered with, what is it, campanula?
Campanula?
Is that what it is?
Which one? I wonder.
The soil is hard and dry.
Yeah, I wonder which one he means. It's probably the one we, in good fun, call Hell's Bells. Campanula.
Campanula.
Loideas. It's a really aggressive, horrible, evil thing, but it does. And you can never get rid of it if you get it in a garden. So that's why we nicknamed it Hell's Bells when I used to live in Rockford, Illinois. Growing something with that is going to have to be pretty aggressive. And maybe just something like the native Virginia creeper, the vine, but use it as a ground cover. Maybe it would it would definitely grow through all that and add a really, a great plant. Virginia creeper, we don't realize the flowers are really, really nectar rich and great for a lot of pollinators. And then the fruits in the fall are great for songbirds. Great fall color, has a lot of interesting insects, a lot of neat sphinx moths that feed on the foliage. So might be something I would put in to at least try to somewhat smother the campanula. So
it would compete with the campanula.
Yeah, it would. It definitely would. Okay. Yeah, it would wind around through it and sprawl over it. And yeah, it probably might be my best idea there.
Helen in Manitowoc. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just have a question about flowers. I buy them at greenhouses. I put them in pots around my backyard, which is pretty much shady, but I buy new Gideon patients and some of these new colors and some other things in pots, but I don't see any bees and things like that around them. Is it because they're newer cultivars, hybridized maybe or whatever, and does that mean that they don't have the pollen, they don't have all of those things that we need to attract the birds and the butterflies?
Right, a lot of those have been bred simply to please our eyes, and those aspects of the plant are no longer there. And so, you can't go wrong with planting some natives. And I even have a little section in the book about talking about, container plantings. Sure. For someone like you, putting things like a beautiful maidenhair fern in a pot in a shady setting and then maybe having some wild strawberries spill out of the bottom, I mean, there's... you'd be surprised. There's a lot of opportunity that you could do even in containers with natives.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. When we lost you on air there for a few minutes, I started to talk about your book again, and I mentioned the number of photographs. So maybe you could. How many do you have in the book? I mean, you must.
That's a good question. I took, 99% of them, almost all of them are mine, and I tried to, use only pictures I took in the Midwest from all the states involved. Obviously a picture says 1,000 words, so I tried to pick the most ornamental aspect of each plant and cover it with that image. So a lot of pictures are from Wisconsin. I'm looking at one from, I can remember taking at Chewaukee Prairie and some from Curtis Prairie at the UW Arboretum and from Borner Botanic Gardens outside Milwaukee. I've got pictures and, the International Crane Foundation, pictures from there. So,
and then along with it, I mean, you've got great descriptions of each of these plants. Talk a bit more about that.
Right. I tried to really make it focus this for a home gardener. It seems like there's so many books that are, a wildflower book about where to go see them in the wild, but this is really focused on a gardener putting them in their garden. So each one has a section on how to grow it, you know, where it's native and what you need to do to grow it in your own garden. And then it's landscape use, again, how it can function for you, whether it's a shade plant or a ground cover, or it brings in beneficial insects, or it makes a good screen or a good component to a food forest or whatever, something in its landscape use. And then lastly is the, you know, the beautiful ornament of it. You know, what does it have, pretty fall color? Are the fruits beautiful in winter? Are the flowers really pretty? Is the foliage texture unique or interesting or colorful? Try to do that and keep it in that order, because when you're selecting one of these for your garden, that's, you know, always think about, will it grow under the conditions you have first? And then, is it going to do what you want it to do? And then, hopefully, the icing on the cake adds beauty to your landscape. So that's how each one is written.
Yeah, it's an amazing book. David in Harvard, Illinois, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. I have an area about 3 acres. It's row planted with oaks and pines. I'm going to thin it out quite a bit. Right now, underneath the oaks and pines, there's not much growing. But I also have another area, you know, in that same general area that has a lot of box elders. We're going to take all those out. A lot of garlic mustard in that area. And we want to raise some sheep and graze that area. What would you recommend for plants in that kind of the box elder area? It's pretty moist.
All right. Native plants that sheep might graze on.
That's an interesting topic. No one's ever asked me that before, so you've got me good on that one. I guess I would go with some of the cool season native grasses, like the bottle brush rye and the silky wild rye and the Virginia wild rye. They would be native in that kind of, or grow really well under those conditions, and probably also be a very good forage because they green up early and also are green late, and even through the winter some green on them. So that's it. And the genus is Elymus, E-L-Y-M-U-S. So any of those woodland ryes. There's also a Canada wild rye, but that really needs more sun and would really be more of a sunny choice. But those are the first things that I would try to get in there.
Yeah.
Can you give me the Latin name again?
The Latin name?
Elymus. Elymus, E-L-Y-M-U-S, and okay. There's Elymus hystrix is the bottle brush grass, Elymus villosus is the silky wild rye, very beautiful, and Elymus virginica, the Virginia wild rye, those would all be some really good choices.
Oh, great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Marcia from Milwaukee emailed to say that the Friends of Weir are holding their annual native plant sale on Mother's Day weekend at the Weir Nature Center. Have you been to that center?
Oh, yes. Love that place. I would love to go to that, especially when I've got a new garden I'm starting. got to hit up a lot of these places to get good native plants.
It's it's a fantastic facility and a whole lot of fun to be able to just go to that area. That nature center is wonderful. And have you guys got any big events coming up at the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum?
Well, we have a spring plant sale too in May by our auxiliary. But right now our big display is from actually a Wisconsin artist from Door County. His name is Robert Anderson. It's called Gardens of Kaleidoscopes. So we have 15 of those placed. These are his designs, and they basically are, you know, you're looking through a kaleidoscope into a central planter of flowers, and really is a neat experience. So that's our summer exhibit here.
Oh, well, I tell you what, it's been a real pleasure to be able to talk with you. I hope we can visit again, Alan. It's been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. Alan Branghagen is Director of Operations at Minnesota Landscape Arboretum and author of the book Native Plants of the Midwest. And it's all fun to have him with us for Garden Talk. And thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.